sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
That's what pro sports teams do. They actually can see that player in real time as opposed to just a simulation. And sales leaders don't get that piece, right? There's this whole inside of pro sports, there's this whole thing going on, and I'm hell-bent on breaking it. I had a one-on-one. I was on a guy today with an NFL executive on the partnership about 2 hours before this call. And I go, "Where are you spending all of your time?" He goes, "Well, Lance, I'm doing a one-on-one with my salespeople every week." I said, "So you have seven people on your team. That's 7 times 4.3. You're spending over a week a month just in one-on-ones. Why? What are you accomplishing there?"
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. That was Lance Tyson. Lance is president and CEO of the Tyson Group, a sales consulting and training firm. He's also the author of a new book titled Igniting Sales IQ, Driving Sales Confidence During Uncertainty. And in our conversation today, we dig into how to effectively sell during times of uncertainty like we're experiencing now. We start by digging into the fact about selling that a lot of salespeople don't recognize, which is that selling takes place in the buyer's mind. We get into why, with the use of technology, whether it be the internet, email, marketing automation, sales tech, whatever, that there are more salespeople now than there's ever been. As Lance points out, what that means is that certain sales are complex enough that buyers need to have a human involved to help them make a decision, to help them through their buying process. And we dive into why salespeople need to keep it simple and learn the process of leveraging their EQ, their emotional intelligence, so they can start to tip the scales in their favor. Because let's face it, just like a casino, the sales odds are stacked in the buyer's favor. It's a fascinating discussion, and we get to all this and much, much more. But before we get to Lance, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could leave us a review, give us your feedback about how we're doing. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it. Lance, welcome back to the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Andy. Glad to be back.
That's a pleasure. So remind people what you do, because you have one of the more interesting, sales training businesses out there.
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. Tyson Group we believe sales is an ultimate team sport. So we compete against some of the bigger training companies. We've been recognized by Selling Power and Training Industry and things like that. Our niche is we do a lot in sports and entertainment. So you think of the brand, you think of the team that you like. That's us. It was a couple of weeks ago. I was in Seattle with the Mariners, and I was at the bar with having a couple of drinks with their sales executive team, and they're a customer. And then the bar was cheering for a new team in Seattle called the Kraken, who's also a customer of ours. Right. So it was kind of interesting to see customers cheering for each other. But much like any other business, sports and entertainment, depends what you sell in sports, can be semi-complex to a complex sale. The complex sales are the big partnership deals they do, all the way to the semi-complex, maybe, you know, selling high-end hospitality, which is all B2B selling. And that's about 60% of our business. So it kind of attracts talent to our business. And I'm told by my people, it's sexy. So I guess if that's the word. So the interesting part of our business is we're pretty boutique-y. So everything we do is tailored. So we come in with a frame and we really tailor everything we do to specific with the we believe our customers suffer from the disease of uniqueness. That's what we believe.
Well, they all do. That's the problem with one of the mindsets we have in sales in general is that everybody wants to make it a cookie cutter.
Right.
And all the customers are unique.
They really are. They really this year we've turned our business a little bit. We do a ton of consulting now. It's probably 30% of our mix. And we have this IP we call Sales Team 6, and it's sales leadership, sales management, which we distinctly believe are two things: sales process, methodology, enablement, which you and I were talking about before, technology, and then talent. And inside that sales process and methodology, people are just all over the place with what they think their methodology is as opposed to what it should be. And it is unique, and it's hard to really help them see there are some things that are the same, though, too.
Yeah. But I think that in general in sales, people try to say that, well, you know, the acumen part of selling is in recognizing how one opportunity is like another. And I think it's really the inverse. I think it's recognizing how one opportunity is different from others.
I agree. And I think I think you can scale a little bit when you look for things that are the same, but then you're going to have to go in there and a lot, especially a complex or semi-complex sale. You're going to also have to understand, like you said, the uniqueness or what's different, right? And because people you sell to want to feel that you've really taken into consideration their issue, their situation.
Well, that you really understand what makes them unique.
Very much so.
I was just having a conversation with somebody. He was talking about, you know, how do you differentiate? And in my mind, it starts with understanding. You know, degree that you have an understanding of the buyer and things that are most important to them is then you have the ability to understand the uniqueness and differentiate accordingly.
I agree. It's so interesting you say that because so many salespeople we deal with and sales leaders, they really feel it necessary. They really want to understand a vertical or really understand. I was on with a younger salesperson with the Cowboys recently, and she goes, I need to really understand these verticals. I go, you do, but at the same time, when you get in face to face with somebody or Zoom to Zoom with somebody, I think you got to understand their world. And that's different than understanding an industry.
Right.
Because every single business has its own acumen and the own way to look at things. And that heightened listening and understanding, listening to understand versus listening to respond, is critical. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, so you'd mentioned a second ago about this is a topic I've love talking about, is the difference between leadership and management.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
So I think when we pull or go in and work with an organization, I'll ask a question like, do you see yourself more as a leader or manager? And most people would say, well, more a leader. And I go, well, what's really the difference? And then I'll have the group, you know, give a definition. And what dawned on me over the years is most people think they're similar things. There's similarities to it, or it's just the word you choose, but everybody gravitates the word leadership. And the way we break it down is, if you kind of this will take a minute, but if you follow my train of thought, you know, we ask the question, what's the difference between art and science, right? And people will say art is subjective. You know, people say science can be proven. Okay, unless you're in COVID, right? I mean, I guess there's a lot of arguments.
Before that, we thought that,
Before COVID, that's kind of what we thought. And then I'll say, okay, if you put them each in a column, then take the next word, take music and lyrics. Where does music go? Where do lyrics go? That usually causes a tremendous debate, especially if somebody was ever a musician. But at the end of the day, I don't know about you, but for years I've listened to Howard Stern. He's really tamed down. One of the questions he always asks as a musician is, can you read sheet music? And I always found that an interesting question.
Right.
And a half of them can't.
Right.
But music is a science. There's eight notes to it. Can you read sheet music or not? So music really goes, in this argument, goes to the science side. And lyrics if you ever listen to a Bob Dylan song or like a rap song,
sure,
right? Like how, I mean, that's open to interpretation what that means. So those two end up lining up. And then you'll ask, then I ask the question, what's the difference between efficiency and effectiveness? Can you be efficient and not effective? And can you be effective and not efficient? Right. And then people will go, well, that's kind of, I said in a performance review, would you want to be efficient or effective? Most people say effective. Okay. So being effective is in turn open to interpretation. So we'd stick that under art. Efficiency is kind of more, I can make 1,000 phone calls, right? It doesn't mean I can sell anything.
Right.
Okay, last two concepts, real simple, right? Do it right or do the right thing. What's do it right mean? What's do the right thing mean? Somebody says, well, do the right thing is, it's kind of open to interpretation. I go, yeah, you might lose a popularity contest by doing the right thing. I mean, it's value driven and things like that. Do it right usually infers you're following a process. Okay. Right. Then when you start landing that, after we do that exercise, they go, where does leadership go? Where's management go? And people go, oh, leadership kind of goes under the art. Yes. And then management goes under the process. So then the argument becomes, how can you say your job is only the art side? The art happens to be the people side. So that would be vision and people skills and understanding motivation, right? Management would be things like plan, organize, direct, coordinate, control, probably in that order too, right? So they're that's the process of management. And then you have functions of leadership, and you probably got to be good at both in most of your jobs. And then, so the question is, the next question we always ask is, do you lean more to the leadership side or more the management side? And then that's when you start getting the split in the room, right? Because the split in the room then becomes, some people go, yeah, even though I like the word leadership, I'm actually more management oriented. So our goal always, and the way we look at sales management and sales leadership are two different things. Sales management is your KPIs, the predictable process. Mm-hmm. Sales leadership is culture and understanding motivation. So we split them that way. We really split the atom there because we think they're just two different things.
Yeah. Well, and I think the question becomes is, and you touched on it earlier, is ideally someone in a leadership role combines both. But yeah, I find too often the case is that's not the case, right? Is that people are either have the art down and sort of follow that, or yeah, I sort of stopped calling it managers. I just call them, they're just bosses.
Right. Yeah.
You want to be a boss or you want to be a leader?
Yeah, no doubt. But when you do get into the management concept, right? And you really start to think about it, and you think about salespeople that get into leadership, what are they usually poor at? So anytime we do an assessment, and when we do talent assessments, and we do them to look at the DNA of a team, but we do competency-based assessments and also kind of pre-hire stuff. We really demand that of our customers because there's just too much science out there not to do it.
Right.
And you're going to go spend $90,000 and you're not going to spend $1,000 to see what you got competency-wise. Right. It's silly. Well, when we look at those things and do an assessment, especially any succession planning for somebody going to move up, usually, like for instance, most salespeople are ready, fire, aim. Most salespeople are problem solvers, not problem finders. Well, when you look at the root of those things, that's really planning and critical thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the management side really does be, you know, kind of grows out of being able to plan, having a predictable way to put a plan together. Then if you can plan, you can ultimately organize. If you can organize, right, then you can direct your resources. If you can direct your resources, then you can coordinate. The last thing you want in management, and your comment to bosses, right, is control. Most very young leaders try to control everything first. And that's immaturity. You got to then get people to buy into the plan. Then you got to get people, you got to understand motivation. The mm-hmm. other big thing is, from a leadership perspective, a lot of sales leaders think they have to be some motivational figure or character. And it's such a joke. I'm like, get out of that business. It's not a one size fits most.
Also, right? It begets the whole argument. Is motivation extrinsic or intrinsic?
And it is. I mean, by definition, in Latin, it means from within. It's not outer. It's from within. You got to understand motivation. So then, when we start breaking that down, because our mission statement, and we believe this firmly, and I got this. I'm a big admirer of Stanley McChrystal's group, the McChrystal Group. Mm-hmm. They you know, he wrote the book Team of Teams,
right.
And they believe leader, you work through leaders to get to the critical mass. So our mission statement is we work through sales leaders and their teams to compete in the complex world. That's our mission statement. So like, we won't even take on a project if we can't touch leadership. We just really have no interest in the project. It's a waste of time for us because there's too many. And like, that's where we, I think, are philosophically is the difference for us as we approach business. We're a pain in the ass to work with at the end of the day.
How do you affect change if you can't deal through leadership?
Exactly. And how can you affect it? Well, because what we tell a lot of leaders, anytime anybody does sales training, right? I'm pretty passionate about it. I've been in the training business my whole life. I started with Dale Carnegie training years ago. And I think at the end of the day, sales leaders need to understand anytime you bring any organization in, have somebody watch a video, read a book on sales, you essentially are abdicating responsibility to somebody else because it's your KPI to train people. That is your KPI as a sales leader. Mm-hmm. And so when we go in, we're like, hey, we're an extension of your arm at the end of the day.
Hmm. Yeah, I think we, in general, and I'm curious in your take on this, but then we'll talk about your book.
We came to talk. Yeah, no worries. I love that. I can talk about this concept because it causes so much friction in organizations. Yeah. It really does.
So my belief is that in general, I people listen to the show, hear me say it almost every episode, is that, you know, people want to point the fingers at managers for being incapable of doing certain things, but we don't ever train them to do these things that we expect them to do. And so I always say, like, geez, if, you know, figures are, we spend about $15 billion a year in sales training in the United States. Yeah. Most of which is spent on training individual contributors, right? Is what if we flipped the fractions? What if we spent 90% of that $15 billion on training managers?
Yep.
Would we have the same impact, better impact? I think we'd have better impact.
I agree. You'd have better impact. I mean, you look at any evidence of why people leave jobs. Typically, money, compensation is the third reason, usually number one or number two. And this is for 20 years. If you look at anything out of the Society for Human Resource Management, it's usually the boss is the issue.
Yeah, there was just something came out from Gallup to the same effect. Gallup has always been reporting this, but there was some recent Gallup report that, you know, substantiated that.
No, you are dead on. I think for we just were having a branding conversation on this yesterday with my team, and we were talking about content for the next year, and I'm really pushing hard to get out of always posting blogs or anything just around sales effectiveness. Our messaging, our audience has to really go more toward the leader.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually who our buyer is. More importantly than that, though, is to affect that change and longstanding change. I mean, you're not going to get what you need to if you're not doing those things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just, yeah, managers are so ill-equipped. And so what happens, I find, is that they default to the KPIs, right? Because we haven't enabled them to understand how to work with an individual, help them improve their performance, how to, you know, help them do the things they need to do to get better. First of all, because the manager's own base of experience is pretty slim, right? Because they're newly promoted. But I find this problem goes all the way up the chain.
It does.
Look at the contrast, like in professional sports. So you work with teams. I'm not a huge soccer fan, and look at the coaching staffs and the way they train these performance based professions for improvement is dramatically different than in sales, which is
great. Agreed.
Which is essentially the same pursuit, just, you know, it's not physical, it's mental.
Well, we talk about that so much. There's two concepts. In sales, you spend 90% of your time on the game field, right?
Yeah.
90% of your time is playing the game in sales. And then when you look at coaching in pro sports, it goes practice coach, game coach, practice coach. Okay. Now, when we look at best practices with sales leaders, I look at their KPIs and I look at why their job exists. They spend very few time game coaching people. It's always after, before they lose that whole piece. And so they always ask our team questions like, okay, how do I do game coach? I go, well, you go on a joint call, for instance, you go with Andy on a joint call, you don't sell. When's the last time you just didn't sell on a call or get some kind of technology we can watch and you game coach? See, that's what pro sports teams do. They actually can see that player in real time as opposed to just a simulation. And sales leaders don't get that piece, right? They spend, I don't know, there's this whole, inside of pro sports, there's this whole thing going on, and I'm hell-bent on breaking it. One-on-one. I had a one-on-one. I was on a guy with today, an NFL executive on the partnership about 2 hours before this call. And I go, where are you spending all your time? He goes, well, Lance, I'm doing a one-on-one with my salespeople every week. I said, so you have seven people on your team. That's 7 times 4.3. You're spending over a week a month just in one-on-ones. Why? What are you accomplishing there? Then we start to break it down. And we're on a retainer with this organization. Start to break it down. I go, shit, like half the stuff you're talking about one-on-one should be handled in your sales meeting. Now tell me about the cadence of your sales meeting.
Mm-hmm.
What are you trying to accomplish there? And then as we went through and start to editorialize that there's six things in a sales meeting you shouldn't be doing. The first thing was announcements. I was like, man, like I just, but the guy's intent
slack
was
for.
Right. His intent was right. It was right. Where he's spending his time is wrong because he's not observing his salespeople. He's observing metrics. He's
right.
Okay. Metrics only tell so much.
Well, so you beg an interesting question: is what is the purpose of a one-on-one, or is there still value in a one-on-one? Maybe not with the same frequency that he's doing it, but
yeah, it's an interesting question. We're really big on, and your audience might really be challenged with what I'm about to say here, so you're gonna have to really take this with a rub. we coach leaders to be consistently inconsistent.
So
if you're running one-on-ones for a period of time, you would stop running them also, or you would do them infrequently, or you kind of plan that out. Being over predictable is not always a great thing. Mm-hmm. So I find there's so much of a rhythm people get in, and then they can't break out of the rhythm. They don't know why they're having a one-on-one. So you said something about frequency. I'm more apt to have open office hours for certain people. I got a couple of salespeople on my team that report to my VP that don't need a one-on-one. But when they come asking for help, mm-hmm. you should be ears up. So you shouldn't be overly predictable with what you do. Mm-hmm. All the time, you should think about that in unpredictability a little bit. We're more apt to have the seller drive the one-on-one. Yeah, there's some time you want to catch up, get to know people deeper, spend a little time with them as a human, get that. You shouldn't be talking about their pipeline there, other than if it's something you had to correct, that pipeline should be dealt with in a pipeline meeting, right?
Right.
So it should be planned out more that way. And I think what's happening is there's this, and I don't know where it comes from. I know where it comes from in pro sports. There's one of the leagues that really starts promoting concepts and everybody bites on it for some reason. It's like the flavor of the week. So I know where that comes from. But it seems this concept of these overdone one-on-ones, and I think people's intent to do the one-on-ones is right. I think what they're accomplishing isn't right. Mm-hmm. And I think it's gobbling monster amount of time up with folks. Do some people need personal attention? Yes. Do they need that much? I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, I tend to agree. I mean, I think that I wonder if perhaps this person you're talking to, some of this came about as a result of remote work and so on, is that.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, when you're in an office, yeah, you know, I would always have a lot of one-on-ones with my team, but they would be me standing in the doorway for 10 minutes.
Informal. I like informal sometimes. Yeah. I mean, it could, I would say a couple of these organizations, this was happening way before COVID, and I think number one, the first thing we see is what they're trying to accomplish should be accomplished with the group. There's more power in coaching the herd together. Mm-hmm. So they're trying, a lot of people are trying to do pipelines in these one-on-ones, or trying to coach in the one-on-ones and things like that. So there needs to be more structure with how they do joint calls. And then there needs to be work of what they're trying to accomplish in their sales meeting every week, or biweekly sales meeting, whatever they're having. Right. And then we break that down. We actually find out most of them are having too many meetings in one meeting anyway. Like, mm-hmm. if you're going to have a pipeline meeting, have the pipeline meeting. Don't have, you know, don't be announcing the company picnic there too. Right. Like,
well, so that's what Slack is for.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. We're converting over to that. I'm kind of excited. I have a whole project team on that. We're excited about going to that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's great. I mean, the messaging is, in general, I think saves so much time in terms of people being able to communicate. And if you have a good culture and people use it effectively, I think it's a great tool. We use it a lot.
Yeah. We're going to convert over to it. That will be a whole thing. Getting everybody to buy into it's going to be the big thing, as it always is, right? So compliance.
Yeah. Well, I think people find they see the utility of it, then they'll buy into it pretty quickly. So I did want to, while we still have some time, let's talk about your new book. Especially, as I told you before we started recording, it starts with one of my favorite criteria, is short. But it's called Igniting Sales EQ, Driving Sales Confidence During Uncertainty. And so was this something you wrote specifically, sort of in response to the pandemic?
You know, it couple things, yes. I mean, one was all the coaching we were doing was more around, I was finding sales leaders were really becoming counselors at some level, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that was definitely an issue. And two is, being tone deaf or not being tone deaf or in the pandemic with customers and things like that, because everybody was really dealing with all kinds of things. You had the haves and have nots in COVID, and you still have that at some level. So I decided, like, we were coaching so much that I said, let me do something on EQ. And I'm not I struggle with the concept myself, because part of me, when I'm coaching salespeople or our team is coaching salespeople, sometimes over empathizing things in sales is not a great move.
No.
It's not. I would prefer, I think Dale Carnegie said, sympathy is great. Be sympathetic to people's ideas and desires because they gave birth to them. So sympathy is as much of a good play as anything else. So I struggled with the concept, but as I started to do more research on it and really started digging into self-awareness, mm-hmm. having that radar, I really start to respect it more and understand it more than I ever had. So yeah, I did write it for the pandemic, but I wrote it really more for leaders. And then I interviewed a gentleman who's currently the president of global sales for Legends, and Legends is owned by Cowboys and Yankees and an investment firm.
Right.
And he talked about what happened in way back in 07, 08 during the meltdown when he was at Madison Square Garden selling a lot to really big Wall Street firms. So it really kind of helped the book take off. His name is Mike Andreiko, and it was great.
Yeah, so. you quote him throughout. I mean, I think he had... Yeah, it's a great quote, which sort of speaks to this idea. Because I think I think we're always in a time of uncertainty. at least I look over the arc of my career and the decades of my career, is there's rarely been a time, whether because of financial market disruptions, massive inflation, foreign wars, whatever, that there's always this element of uncertainty.
Yeah, I agree. You're so right. And it really depends what industry you're in too, right? So you got to be ready for that uncertainty. And I don't think that EQ is, I think it's taught. I don't think it's recognized. I mean, it comes out with things like, part of me says, having the dealing with uncertainty or dealing with an uncertain personality sometimes. Sitting across from somebody and just completely misreading them, or hitting the panic switch when your Zoom works and they don't. You're on a first call and there's uncertainty in so many things. That's where your people skills come out. That's where your own self-awareness comes out. So as I started to dive deep, it doesn't have to necessarily be complex for me either. That mm-hmm. I think that emotional intelligence. And I think really at the end of the day, the it's that conversation you have with yourself. You know, sometimes your mind's like a bad neighborhood. It's not good to be alone in it. Right? So that's what I recognize is something I struggle with. So.
Yeah. Well, and I think, yeah, you quote Mike in the book. And for me, this has always been something almost from the beginning of my career is I'd heard a lecture about this is he talked about, you got the quote, you know, we've got to become masters in sailing through the tough times while maintaining a tolerance for ambiguity. And I remember hearing this lecture, I said very early in my career for this business school professor, I was at a sales kickoff meeting actually, talked about, he thought the primary skill that sellers needed to master in order to have a successful career was developing a tolerance for ambiguity.
It's so true. I talk about this a lot, and the ambiguity is you might need to be comfortable with 80% of the information and go. And you're going to have to, that ambiguity, like you just said too, that tolerance for that, that also means you're able to risk or have a tolerance to risk also, because you may fail, you may succeed. And I really see that a lot in sales. And how well somebody does performance-wise.
Yeah, well, I think it gets back to something we sort of touched on briefly before, though, is this idea that, you know, it's being pushed more and more in sales these days is, you know, hey, here's the persona of who you're calling on. These are the websites to visit, the things they like to read, yada, 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 yada. And they want you to take this, you know, cookie-cutter approach. Mm-hmm. And you're going to get in front of that person and find out, no, they're not really like that persona at all.
Yes.
And sure. And if you think that everybody's going to be the same, yeah, you're going to be sorely disappointed because, you know, there are, what, how many billions of people in the world these days? 7.5 billion or something. And each one of them are their own unique person.
Yeah. And it's that macro to micro, right? It's we want to categorize people in certain buckets, and I'm going to walk a line here and be careful. When we sell, though, put an ideal prospect profile is okay, but understanding that you're going to very much need to get to know that person, connect with them uniquely, human to human,
yep.
is at play, and it's not probably going to match up. It's going to be much different. It's going to be much different when you engage somebody.
Yeah, and that sort of speaks to mindset then. I think, again, I think tolerance for ambiguity is a mindset, but part of that, you know, may add on to that is – yeah, you just want to go in as a seller. You're better off going in not assuming anything when you enter that conversation, rather than assuming that things have to go a certain way or unfold a certain way. Otherwise, you're going to be disappointed.
Agreed. The thing I talk to leaders and salespeople about, the thing you could probably assume, one thing, is you don't want to waste, you want to run the odds that you don't mm-hmm. want to waste people's time. And that's right. About it. That's probably the universal kicker right there. Across every different. And other than that, everything else is game. And it's, I think the EQ concept allows for going to your concept of ambiguity is what, if I had to pull one thing out of that, it's the ability. It's not what you project on other people. It's how you deal with yourself and how agile you can be. Mm-hmm. Or do you come in and realize that, you know, all right, I'm not going to get done what I think I'm going to get done here today. I'm not going to get it to a second meeting. I'm going to get to a meeting 1A. Or I'm not going to close this deal here. They're going to punt, but I'm going to have to be okay with it, because if I act any other way, I'm going to come off aggressive. And this is I've never done business with these folks before, so there's not going to be, and it's that ambiguity or that ability to be agile in the moment is key. The other thing, though, I think you'll find this is interesting. Some of the research we're doing right now is we're seeing the sales processes, especially since the pandemic, and anything complex, right, or semi-complex, or this hybrid selling model. I was mm-hmm. on the phone recently with this, with one of my salespeople in this president's manufacturing company, and he kind of was accusatory to me. He goes, you keep talking about this hybrid sales model, and we need our people to be face-to-face. And I said, it sounds like you're saying that I'm inferring you need some kind of hybrid sales model. I said, is that correct? He goes, that's what it feels like. I said, well, I didn't mean it that way, but I can certainly tell you, you're stating you need your people face-to-face with people. My only question is, what if your prospects don't want to be face-to-face? I think you have a little bit of an issue. I said, your ability to see it how it used to be as opposed to what it's going to be, even if that shifts 20 or 30% toward opposite the way you want it, they're going to have to be agile, right? So I think inside of sales today, we have to adjust in I agree with you. It always changes, and it's not going to back to what it was. Today, it is what it's going to be until it adjusts again.
Again, right?
Sales processes are fragmented. So you got this big fragmentation going on. So you have these little bursts of conversations. You got Zoom fatigue. You got this. And that EQ, just on the sales side, to calm down, because I guess I don't fish or hunt. But I would assume it'd be pretty damn hard to fly fish. Never have done it. I'm an antsy person. I'm assuming if you move a lot in the water, you're going to scare stuff away, and you got to be patient enough to keep doing something like this. And that's kind of how it is in sales right now. It's just fragmented. And if you're not in your head the right way, you're going to struggle. I think it's that way in business though, too. I think good salesperson, good business person today.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it, the fragmentation is owed to the fact that, or down to the fact that, you know, sellers are sort of unclear in their mind what their job is.
Yes.
And so if they go out every morning and think their job is to persuade someone to buy their product, you know, you're starting from a bad position.
Agreed. You know, this asymmetrical now goes to, one time salespeople held the information. Right now, if you go back to what you said again, that ambiguity, chances are, right, wrong, or indifferent, the buyer may have access to even more information than you do, or more opinions, because they can form opinions on everything. And your job right now is not to persuade them, is to kind of figure out how much information they have and where you're going to move. Or how to move, right? It's the Florida State Sales Institute did a study kind of challenging the challenger model. It's done about 5 years ago. Do you see that Florida State study? Did you ever see it?
No, but I'm interested in hearing about it. Yeah.
So what they found, they tried to beat the challenger model. And so they looked at about 123 companies and their top performers. And as they start to look at it, they realize that all the top performers that they studied typically had two to three strategies on any situation. So they were agile, right?
Yep.
They had multiple strategies. They were agile, right? Mm-hmm. So they were changelings at some level. That's what the study came out as they tried to challenge the challenger model. I'll send it over to you. It's really interesting, but we've actually based a lot of what we do now. If it's semi-complex or complex, what are your three moves every time? Because of the fragmentation, it's so bad. Like, you might not get it from meeting one to meeting two. You might get to meeting 1B, and that has to be okay. You may not be able to negotiate here because they're going to cancel the meeting, or not everybody's going to be there, and it's going to be fragmented again. And not that that's so different, but I think it's magnified a little bit today.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it gets back again to ambiguity, right? Is how do we, you know, how do we prepare people? Yeah, take a step back. And, you know, you talk about, you know, sales process being fragmented. As I've always sort of really thought about as selling is, it's a collection of moments.
Yes. Yes.
And it's, what do you do in those moments? Because you have very few moments, right? The moments meaning you're interacting with the buyer. It's what you do in those moments. And to your point, is there's a lot of ambiguity about what could happen in any one of those moments. And so it's, how do you prepare people with the instincts to do the right thing in these moments that matter?
So everybody's listening, as you're hearing what Andy's saying, is it's these collections of moments where you have to glue them together. If you take that concept and you take it a step further, it's also then taking the moments and recognizing where's the natural momentum of it? And then what do you need to do to create artificial momentum to keep them glued together or advance it?
Right.
And I think a lot of salespeople don't realize that. We're doing some consulting with, we've looked at everything from leadership to their sales process with this company that kind of does what like a Nielsen Ratings does. I can't name them because of confidentiality, but that's who they would compete against or inside that the genre. And we were told by their senior team that they're relationship sellers, and we came back and assessed and looked at their deals, and I go, yeah, they're relationship sellers, but you guys need to be consultative sellers. You're not even looking at this right. And they said, okay, what's that look like? And we built out a model for them. And then we started to look at their deals, big deals, small deals. And every deal was 6 months. And with a few that were maybe a third shorter. And as we looked at all their deals, and then we started to talk to the salespeople and how they're strategizing the sales leadership teaming, is they weren't doing little things to keep those moments glued the right way.
Right.
It's interesting, Andy, several of their deals, you know, you behave differently in an unsolicited sale versus a solicited sale. You get a lead that comes in that already has natural momentum. There's reasons to move it very quickly, and you can get to a different spot. They weren't even recognizing little things like that. So then every deal was the same length, when in turn, the unsolicited deals should have been a third shorter, but it's not paying attention. And I think that comes down to a concept, right?
Yep.
A couple concepts. One, you know, inside their sales process, they were more worried about relationships. Well, relationships are outcomes. You might need to be a great agitator to sell certain things.
Right.
Right. Second thing is they didn't know what they were going for meeting for meeting. Like you said, what's my purpose? What am I supposed to do in this moment?
Right.
And I think the third thing, they weren't respecting something that was unsolicited versus solicited. So they didn't recognize natural momentum. Right. So in a sale. So it's interesting. It's interesting how people look at things. What was the big problem? They treated everything the same. One size fits most.
Right. Yeah. So, well, here's our playbook.
Yeah.
I mean,
it goes back to what we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
You know, cookie cutter, right? Yeah. Back to the cookie cutter again. So.
Yeah. And again, you had another quote from Mike Andreyko in the book is he says, but for all the right deals, when you're sitting in that room, there's a quote, you're going to have to make decisions that don't exist in any playbooks. And
that goes back to your ambiguity, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the things that, you know, perhaps we do a disservice to sellers in general is this sort of, you know, this sort of tradition that's kind of passed down over the decades since, you know, Patterson at NCR was, you know, they feel like they need to go into meetings with the answers. And if you're going into a situation that's a lot of ambiguity, you really need to be prepared with the questions.
It's true. It's so true and interesting. You brought Patterson up at NCR a couple of weeks ago. My son visited University of Dayton and the Patterson Museum that's right there. I brought him by.
Right.
I told him the whole story. I taught him. I also said, do you know what he did one time? He actually burnt. He deconstructed the whole. All the salespeople kept coming to the office, and he wanted them out of the office. And he literally. Demolished the sales office when they came back. It was just grazed over. He was get out of the office. So there's all kinds of interesting stories about Patterson, but you're right. You know, and I think that goes back to salespeople. Think about this concept for a second, because usually this catches people's eyes. Like I'm big on nomenclature. Probably when I was younger, didn't matter much. But when we go into organizations, like we're just working with an ad firm, and they go, we go in and do a needs assessment. I go, okay, why do you call it a needs assessment? And they go, why wouldn't we? I go, because you don't actually sell anything anybody needs. So why would it be a needs assessment? Why wouldn't it be like an opportunity analysis? And then I had a smart ass salesperson there, and that was probably me when I was younger. And I go, and he goes, why does that matter? I said, well, it matters because it's the kind of question you'll ask. If it's a needs assessment, you're problem solving, not problem finding.
Right.
And you got to find problems and find opportunities, which is different. And he goes, I don't see a difference. I said, well, why don't you do this? Why don't you go back and look at the, think about what I said and then look up the definitions of what I'm saying. He came back and he goes, yeah, that makes sense, man. He goes, that makes sense. I said, yeah, you're probably acting like a bad episode of NCIS as opposed to talking about what's possible. Because, like, look, what you sell is important but not urgent. Yeah. So don't try and sell it that way. So,
yeah, I try to simplify it for people. It's, you know, think about, to your point precisely about problem finders versus problem solvers, is think about the buying journey in sort of three phases. You know, the what phase, the how phase, and the who phase. And the what phase is, what's the problem?
Yep.
Right? And what's the nature of the outcomes you want to achieve? And only then, once you've identified that, can you then go to, well, let's examine the trade-offs and the options we have for how to solve it.
No doubt. No doubt.
And the third order consideration, which sellers have a hard time coming to terms with, is who am I going to buy it from?
That's
exactly. And if you come in as a seller and you try to sell who during the what phase, you're going to have a real hard time.
Absolutely. Well said. Very well said.
All right. Well,
seems like you've been doing this for a little bit, buddy.
Yeah, I've been doing it for a while. All right.
Now, we exchange
ages at the start. I said we exchange ages before we got on the air, so you can't reveal mine. I won't reveal yours.
Don't reveal mine. So please. So I love these conversations. It's so fun to talk to somebody who can see in the distance with sales. So many people see it and it's inch in front of them. Not it's so many variables.
Yeah.
And you got to take all the variables in the context to get it done. And it's not the one thing. It's
right.
Not one thing. So
likewise, Lance, always enjoy it. So tell people about your book. Yeah. If you didn't listen to our last episode with Lance, enjoyed his previous book, Sales is an Away Game, right? Which I think is a great mental image that I always think about. And you refer to it in this book as well. So tell people about this book.
So Igniting Sales EQ is really a roadmap to check off for yourself about how to keep that somewhat calmness in, I'm going to go back to what Andy said, in these ambiguous times or ambiguous situations you're in, where sometimes, if you think about a deal, for instance, sometimes you work in the deal instead of on the deal. Mm-hmm. When you think about Igniting Sales EQ, it's not working through the moment. It's working on the whole roadmap of how you have to deal with things. So it's more of a thinking process than anything else. I take a swat at it from a sales perspective. It's a very short book. It's on Amazon and pretty easy to read. It's quick.
Yep.
It's a quick read. Get it done in a sitting.
So. Easily. Yeah. No, as I prepare for the show, I always read my guest's book and it's always nice to have one that length. So, but as to your point is it's going to force you to think and yeah, just a reminder people, sales is a thinking person's game.
It is a thinking person. It's business, business, right?
Yes, yeah.
Very much.
So, all right.
I appreciate you having me on.
Hey, a pleasure as always. And look forward to doing it again.
Absolutely. Thanks, Andy.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. I'm so grateful for your support of this show. And I want to thank my guest, Lance Tyson, for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for your help with that. And thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.